Well, thanks to Lindsay and the band for leading us in worship. For those of you who may not know, Lindsay is my wife, and she is also 6 months pregnant with our first little baby, so we're very excited about that. It's hard to tell behind the guitar, so thought I'd just say it. So earlier this week, I caved in, and I downloaded Pokemon Go. If you are one of the 100 million people who have not downloaded this app on your smartphone yet, let me just briefly kind of describe how this works. So Pokemon Go is an augmented reality video game, which if you don't know what Pokemon Go is, you probably have no idea what that means. But what it means is that there's this mythical world that in the game maps onto our world sort of in real time, so that in order to move someplace in the game, you actually have to move there with phone in hand, and it moves you through the game. The goal of the game is to try to catch these little creatures called Pokemon. And you do it by swiping up on your phone when you find one to throw a Pokeball at it in the hopes that you catch it. Anywhere that you go in public these days, you can see somebody playing Pokemon Go. And the way that you know that this is what they're doing is because they're walking around with their phone, and all of a sudden, they stop, and they start doing this, and they go, yes, I caught it. So you see this all the time. There's a few different types of Pokemon Go players. There are some who are bashful players, and This is where I still am at this point. These are the players, and this is me. When I walk around, I try to make it look as best as I can like I'm not playing Pokemon. So the phone's down here, and when I see a Pokemon, I kind of look around to see who's looking, and if no one's watching me, then I go ahead and catch it, and I move on, trying to be very inconspicuous about this. There are other people who are moderately invested, we'll say. These are people who, they're not concerned about what people think about them while they're playing this game. They're not trying to hide it, but they recognize that this game is not actually real life, that there is some distinction between what's happening on your phone and what's happening in the rest of the world around you. So these are people that can still kind of distinguish the game from reality. But then there are other players, and we'll call these players completely absorbed players. These are people for whom, when they are playing Pokemon Go, the real world just kind of evaporates. And the only thing that is present in their minds at this moment is the Pokemon that they're trying to catch. And for these people, as they kind of focus in, as they block everything else out, they forget, actually, that they're still in the real world, where there are real people and really dangerous things. So a number of these people have actually gotten hurt while playing Pokemon. A couple of men in Encinitas actually walked off a cliff. You know, they're playing, and there's the Pokemon, and they're over the cliff. Other people walk out into oncoming traffic. People have fallen into ditches and ended up in the ER. These are people who are just completely absorbed with this game. They're not thinking about what other people are thinking about them. They're not thinking about where else they should be maybe while they're playing. For them, they are just completely absorbed, captivated by their mission at hand. Today we're going to look at a story where we find a woman who is completely absorbed with Jesus. And in this scene that we're going to look at, it's as if everything else in the world kind of fades away. And she has this tunnel vision on Jesus. And the only thing that matters to her is loving Jesus with extravagant love. She's not concerned about what people are thinking. She's not thinking about where else she should be or what else she should maybe be doing. For her, the only thing that matters in that moment is loving Jesus with a wild and crazy love. How does she get to this point? What is it that allows her to be able to block out everything else and focus in on Jesus? We're going to find out as we take a look at our story. Last week, we were looking at a story at the beginning part of Luke chapter 7. This is when Jesus healed the centurion's servant. We saw this amazing faith from this Gentile, this outsider. The story for today is at the end of Luke chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. there's a couple things that happen in between that are noteworthy for us. So one of the things, as Jesus is leaving the town of Capernaum where he was, and he and his disciples are approaching the town of Nain, they come across a funeral processional. And as they encounter this funeral processional, Jesus does what we all do when we come across a funeral. He raises the dead man back to life. And everybody around is amazed by this. We see their response in Luke 7, 16 to 17. It says that fear seized them, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him spread throughout the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. So here we find that Jesus does this miraculous thing, and as the people are witnessing this, they start to make judgments about Jesus. And the people who saw this firsthand, their conclusion is that Jesus is a man of God, that he is a prophet, he's sent from God with the power and authority of God. Who else could raise somebody from the dead? But the Pharisees, they're not so convinced. In fact, the Pharisees think quite the opposite about Jesus, that this is not a man of God, that this is not a great prophet who's come. They're not amazed by the things Jesus is doing. They're not amazed by the fact that he raised somebody from the dead. Instead, what stands out in the minds of the Pharisees is Jesus' distasteful social habits. We find this in verse 34 of chapter 7. They say, "Look at him," talking about Jesus, "a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners." So for the Pharisees, they look at Jesus and they say, This guy is not a prophet. This guy is not a man of God. How could he be? He eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners. This guy is a friend of sinners. What man of God could possibly be a friend of sinners? As we were thinking about what to call this series for the summer, Friend of Sinners was one of the titles that we were kind of mulling over. This is a title that shows up at various points in Luke's gospel in the mouth of the Pharisees talking about Jesus in a very condescending way, a friend of sinners. But for Jesus, this is a great thing. This is in fact what he came to do. But as we are thinking about the possibility of entitling our series Friend of Sinners, we thought that that might put some of you in an awkward position when you wanted to invite friends to church this summer. Well, we're doing this series at church. It's called Friend of Sinners. So I was thinking about all the sinners that I know, and you came to mind, so I thought maybe you'd want to come to church. In the end, we thought that invited was probably a more welcoming title. And indeed, this is what we see Jesus doing. He is a friend of sinners, absolutely, but he invites them in a way that we don't see anyone else doing. The Pharisees write Jesus off, friend of sinners and tax collectors, a drunk, a glutton. But we meet one Pharisee today whose name is Simon. Simon has heard the crowds talk about Jesus as a prophet and a man of God. He's also heard his fellow Pharisees condemn Jesus, write him off as someone who could not possibly be a man of God. And Simon, I think, is still undecided. Simon is trying to evaluate Jesus for himself. So he decides to invite Jesus over and some other people and have a dinner party so he can get to know Jesus a little bit better in an attempt to make a judgment about who Jesus really is. So this is what happens in our passage today. So let's take a look in Luke 7, starting in verse 36, as we see this story unfold. One of the Pharisees, we later learn to be Simon, one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, he being Jesus. And he went into the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And behold, a woman of the city, who was a sinner, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." I'm not sure about you, but I've never been to a dinner party quite like this one before. This is quite a scene that is unfolding before us. Just this past weekend, Lindsay and I were having some friends over for brunch on Saturday morning. And we were sitting at our kitchen table, which faces this window that looks out the front of our house. And the way that our house is set up, it's a duplex, and our unit is towards the back of the property. So there's another building in front that you have to walk around down this path to get to our front door. So it's a little bit of a ways. And what this means is that the only people who actually come to our front door are people who we've invited over or the UPS guy delivering a package. So we're sitting down for brunch, and we see these two strangers coming down this path towards our door. And he's not carrying a package, which is strange when someone we don't know is walking to our door. So Lindsay and I stop in the middle of our conversation, and we look at each other, and we say, "Do you know who these people are?" "No." "Do you know?" "No." "Okay, it's a little strange." They come up and they knock on the door, and we come to find out they were actually looking for a different house. They were just in the wrong place. But there was this sense, before we knew kind of what was going on, of discomfort in the room. Why are these people that we don't know, these strangers, coming to our house? We might think that this is something like what happens in this story. But in the ancient world, life was lived much more publicly than it is today. And people had private property, but it was much less private than it is today. So it wouldn't have been strange for this woman to make her way to this dinner party. The way that houses were frequently built at this time is they'd have a big open courtyard in the middle of the house with a table there. And when you would have guests over, you would sit down at this table. But any stranger off the street would be welcome to come in and to sit somewhere around the perimeter of this courtyard. And they could listen in on your conversation and maybe even contribute to your conversation. So in this case, it's actually not strange. It wouldn't have been surprising to people to have this woman walk into this party in this way. But there was something very strange about this situation. It wasn't the woman's presence, it was her reputation. The ESV describes her as a woman of the city. Now, that's actually literally just a phrase that means she's from the same town that this is happening in. But the only other thing that we're told about her is that she is a sinful woman, and that everybody around, everyone in town, knew that she was a sinful woman. She had earned for herself, in some way, the reputation of being a sinner. Now, it's most likely that she was a prostitute. This would have been the kind of career that would have given her this reputation as a woman who is a sinner. So she walks into the room, everybody becomes a little bit uncomfortable. They're making judgments about this woman. Now, as a prostitute, this woman actually would have been a victim, because in that day, much like in our own day, one didn't just choose to become a prostitute because it sounded like a good thing to do. People were forced into this, either literally sold into prostitution by their parents or else left with no other options in the world for making a living for themselves. So forced into it one way or another, this woman has become a prostitute. But when people look at her, what they think is that she's not a victim, she's unclean. She's anathema. She is dirty. We don't want to associate with this woman. So she walks into this party, and it's not so much that somebody walked in, it's that this woman walked in that makes everyone in the room feel uncomfortable. But as we see the scene progress, this is only the beginning of the discomfort, because what she actually does creates a considerable greater amount of discomfort. Jesus would have been lying down on his side at the table, as people did at meals back then, with his feet stretched out behind him. And this woman comes up behind him and starts crying. She starts weeping. And the word here used to describe her tears is the same word that's used to describe a rainfall. So we have this image of tears just pouring out of her eyes onto Jesus' feet. And she washes his feet. And she dries them with the hair on her head. And she starts kissing them. And she takes this expensive ointment, this perfume that she's brought, and she begins to anoint Jesus' feet. All of these actions are culturally significant. We're going to see why in a little bit. But right now, just imagine the scene that this is creating. This woman walks in. Everybody sees her walk over to Jesus and stand behind him. Everybody hears her crying, bawling. People could probably even smell this perfume as she anoints Jesus' feet with it. So everybody's attention is directed towards this woman. She's creating quite a disturbance. And Simon gets upset. But what we see is that Simon does not get upset at what the woman is doing. He actually never comments on that. For Simon, the thing that is upsetting, the thing that is troubling, is that this woman is doing these things to Jesus. That Jesus would let this woman come in, somebody that everybody knows is a sinner, is unclean, that Jesus allows her to come to him and to love him in this way. And Simon, at that moment, he makes up his mind about who Jesus is. Because if Jesus were a man of God, if he were really a prophet, he would not let this woman behave in this way. He would know, Simon says, who and what sort of woman this is. What's Simon saying when he says this? Well, we might think that Simon is suggesting that perhaps Jesus is not a prophet because he doesn't know who this woman is. He doesn't have that sort of prophetic knowledge. But in almost all certainty, Jesus knew who this woman was. Everybody knew who this woman was. At least they knew that she was a sinner. So this much Jesus would have known. So Simon is not so much questioning Jesus' prophetic knowledge. What he is questioning is Jesus' purity. How could Jesus, if he is truly a man of God, let this woman interact with him in this way? Jesus would never risk being contaminated by such a person, by becoming unclean by someone who is so dirty, if in fact he was a prophet, if in fact he was a man of God. So in that moment, Simon decides, clearly, this is not who Jesus is. Clearly, he is a friend of sinners. That's what I was kind of thinking, and he has just proved it, finally, that he is a friend of sinners. He was expecting Jesus to hold this woman at an arm's length, to know that it was not appropriate for someone like this to come to someone like him. But instead, Jesus welcomes this woman in. He doesn't hold her off. He doesn't do anything to her. He just lies there and lets this woman love him in this way. He doesn't require that she cleans herself up first. He doesn't require that she gets her act together before coming. He doesn't require that she sorts out this reputation and changes what people think about her. Instead, Jesus invites her in. And thank God that he does the same thing for us. Jesus does not require that we clean ourselves up before we come to him. He doesn't require that we have everything figured out, that we have all of our spiritual ducks in a row. He doesn't require those things of us. Instead, Jesus just says, come as you are, come as you are. He doesn't hold us at an arm's length. He invites us in. Notice in verse 39, as Simon is making this judgment about Jesus, it says that he says this to himself. Perhaps it was actually just a thought in his mind. Maybe it was something that he mumbled under his breath. But either way, he didn't expect Jesus to hear this. He didn't want Jesus to hear this. But somehow Jesus does. Maybe he hears a mumble, or maybe he actually does actually know what Simon is thinking, even though he hasn't said anything. But either way, this leads Jesus to respond. So let's continue reading in verse 40. And Jesus, answering, said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he answered, say it, teacher. A certain moneylender had two debtors. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now which of them will love him more? Simon answered, the one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. Jesus said to him, you have judged rightly. So as Jesus addresses Simon, he says, in effect, Simon, we need to talk. This is not something you want to hear from your significant other, much less Jesus, but this is what Jesus comes and says, Simon, we need to talk. Simon says, okay, teacher, showing some respect, okay, teacher, what do you have to say? Jesus goes on to tell him a parable. And he says, there's a moneylender, and there's two people that owe him money. One, 500 denarii, the other 50, 10 times less. And in that day, that would have been a significant amount of money, but not an unrealistic amount of money. So 50 denarii would have been something like 2 months' wages for a normal day laborer, and 500 denarii close to 2 years' wages. So this could have been something equivalent to us for an auto loan or a home mortgage, though perhaps not in this area, but in some areas, a home mortgage. So this is a lot of money, but these are realistic numbers. People may have actually been indebted these amounts to different people. In both cases in this parable, the men are unable to pay back their debt. They can't make any payments on it. And in both cases, the men are completely and totally forgiven. The debt is just erased. So which of these two men, Jesus says, which of these two men would love the moneylender more? Simon answers with the obvious and the correct answer, well, I suppose it's the one who had a larger debt. Jesus says, exactly. Now, Simon was a smart guy, and parables were a common way of communicating in this day. So as Simon is hearing this parable, he knows that Jesus has a point. And he knows that oftentimes in parables, the specific people in the parables represent specific people or specific types of people. So how would Simon have understood this parable? Well, first, he would have recognized that God is the moneylender. The idea of people owing a debt to God would have been a very comfortable idea for Simon. This would not have been something that was surprising to him. The Pharisees firmly believed that we all owe a debt to God. And they believed that the law was the way both of minimizing that debt and then of working to pay it off. Right? If we can follow the law in as well as we can, if we can follow it to a certain expectation, then we can work to pay off that debt that we owe to God. So as Simon hears this part of the parable, he's completely on board. Then he hears about these two debtors. And it would not have been a stretch for him to assume that these two debtors represent himself and the woman. One owes a debt 10 times larger than the other. Simon's thinking, clearly this woman has a debt at least 10 times as large as mine, if not more. He's still on board. Then comes the surprising part. Because in this parable, the moneylender completely forgives, wipes out the debt of both men, irrespective of how much they owe, irrespective of who they are, just completely wipes out the debt. There was a parable that rabbis would tell at this time that was very similar to this one, but different in crucial ways. In this parable, there was a moneylender who represented God, and there were two people that owed him money. One person was a friend, the other was an enemy. And in this parable, the moneylender requires the friend to pay back the debt, but puts him on a payment plan, gives him time to do this. He extends the terms of the loan. But for the enemy, he requires immediate payment. So in this parable, in the thinking of the Pharisees and the rabbis at the time, God is still a generous and gracious God to his friends. He gives more time than they should have had to pay back this debt. But to his enemies, he requires immediate payment. So as Simon hears this story about a moneylender, about God, who completely wipes out debt of both debtors, he would have been taken aback by this. He would have been shocked by this unprecedented grace. How is it that God could completely erase debt without requiring any sort of repayment? How is it that salvation could come as a free gift? Simon is just baffled by this idea. Many people today find this same idea surprising, even to the point of unbelievable. God would just forgive my sins without requiring me to pay back this at all? He just wipes out the debt. But that is what Christ has done for us. He has completely removed our debt. He has wiped the slate clean. We can be so thankful that our God is a God of Jesus' parable, not of the rabbis of that time. Well, as Simon heard this parable again, he would have put himself in the place of the one who owed a smaller debt. And he would have seen the woman as the one who owes the larger debt. And Jesus affirms his suspicion about the woman. This woman, in fact, does have a great debt. But Jesus never comments on Simon's debt. He never places Simon in the place of the one who has a smaller debt. And the reason why, I believe, is because Jesus doesn't actually think Simon has a small debt. He wants Simon to recognize that he has a debt that is too large for him to pay off, that he has a significant debt against God, that he is not that different from the woman. So I'm convinced that for Jesus, it's not the amount of debt between this woman and Simon that he's concerned with. Instead, he's trying to draw attention to the type of debt, the type of sin. You see, for this woman, her sins were socially not acceptable. These were unacceptable sins socially. She was a sinner because she was a prostitute. Therefore, she was unclean. Therefore, we need to keep our distance. She has a great debt. Everybody recognizes that. But Simon, too, has a great debt. It's just that his sins are not as obvious as the woman's sins. His sins are not as taboo as the woman's sins. He certainly is full of pride and greed and self-righteousness. He lacks compassion. He lacks generosity. He is full of himself. He's judgmental. But nobody seems to have a problem with these sins. Nobody is calling Simon out on this or labeling him a sinner. So what separates him from the woman is not the fact that he has a smaller debt, but the fact that his debt goes unrecognized by him, that he has actually not realized the dire situation in which he finds himself. I think that all of us, in one way or another, are either like Simon, or we're like this woman. What we have in common with both of them is that we are sinners, that our lives are a mess. Whether on the outside or on the inside, we are a mess. We don't get things right, we fall short, and we do it a lot. The question is, will we be like the woman and see that we actually have a debt, or will we be like Simon and try to ignore that? So often, we fool ourselves into thinking that our debt is small. And we do whatever we can to try to make other people think that we are actually not as much of a mess as we actually are. We try to put up this facade like everything is going well, right? That we don't have the same kinds of problems that other people have. But inside, we know that we're falling apart. Whether or not we want to acknowledge that or not, we know that there are things about us that we do not like, that we fall short in so many ways. We maybe get angry with our spouse or with our kids, and nobody else knows it. Maybe we are consumed with what people think about us, always trying to do whatever we can to make them think well of us. We have all these things going for us on the outside, but on the inside, we know that we are fallen. We may try to deny it, but the fact of the matter is that we are in the same boat as this woman, that we are full of sin, that we are fallen creatures. And like her, we need to recognize this, and we need to allow other people to see this about us. I had the privilege this past week of leading the seniors' Bible study while Scott was at Camp PBC, and we were studying this passage together and talking about some of these ideas, and one of the gentlemen at the Bible study described a situation that he experienced when he was initially exploring Christianity. He had just started to check out some churches, and one Sunday he found his way into an Episcopal church, and as he was sitting there in the service, there was a homeless guy who walked in from the back, and he made his way up towards the front of the church and sat down in one of the pews in front of him. And this guy was dirty, this guy was smelly, this guy was very obviously a mess in some ways. And at Bible study, as this gentleman was talking about his experience of this, what he said was, At that time, on the inside, I was falling apart. Nothing was going well. But on the outside, I had managed to kind of hold things together and make it look like I was doing okay. But when I saw this guy come in, I knew that if he is welcome here, then I must be welcome here. Not just the appearance that I want people to see, but actually who I am, all of my mess, I am welcome here. We need to be a church of messy people. We need to be a church that when we come in here, when we interact with people outside of here, when we live our lives, we're not trying to put up some kind of false persona. We're not trying to hide who we really are so that we look better for other people. We need to let people see that we are a mess, that we are sinners, that we are fallen. It's important for you to recognize that in yourself, but it's so important for you to let other people in on that as well. Because when you do, then they feel the freedom to open up, whether their mess is on the outside or on the inside. We begin to learn as a community that it's okay to be messy people, that actually we are all a mess, we are all sinners, and yet that's why we come here, because that's the way we are, not in spite of that fact about us. The woman understood this. Simon did not. Simon was not willing to recognize in himself or let other people see that he, in fact, had a debt against God. But this woman was able to see this. And as she recognized this, it allowed her to respond to God, to respond to Jesus with an amazing amount of love. And those two things are very closely linked, and Jesus is about to make that point for us. So let's continue reading. Starting in verse 44. Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon. So he's looking at the woman, talking to Simon. Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. As Jesus addresses Simon here, looking at the woman, he's pointing out all of these actions that the woman has done and why they're significant. And all of these things that she does, they have to do with the idea of hospitality in the ancient world. What did it mean to be a good host? And basically what Jesus is saying is, Simon, you have been a terrible host. You have done nothing right since I walked in. And then he kind of explains how that is the case. He says, Simon, I came in and you didn't wash my feet. In that day, after walking around in sandals on the dusty roads, when you would come to someone's house, it was customary. It was just standard practice to offer somebody a bowl of water to wash their feet, to clean up a little bit. Jesus does no such thing. But this woman comes in and she washes Jesus' feet with her tears and wipes them dry with her hair. When a guest would come to your house, it was customary to greet them with a kiss on the hand or on the cheek. But we see Simon extending no such courtesy to Jesus. But this woman, says, has not ceased kissing my feet since she arrived. It was also common, though not required, but oftentimes a host would choose to anoint the head of his guest, the forehead, with a little dab of oil, as, again, sort of a way of freshening up and welcoming them into your house. Simon does no such thing, but this woman brings an expensive jar of ointment, this expensive perfume, and this is what she uses to anoint not Jesus' head, but his feet. And in so many ways, Jesus wants Simon to see, you have completely disregarded the most common of courtesies to me. And yet this woman, who had no responsibility to do these things, no expectation to do these things, has not only fulfilled your duty as a host, but she has gone over and above in extending love to me. She has done all these things that she would not be expected to do, that nobody would be expected to do, that people probably thought were a little bit strange. And yet these are the things that she has done for me because she recognized that she had a great debt and that it has been completely wiped out by me. And because of that, Simon, she cannot help but express herself in love to me. Do we find ourselves responding to Jesus in this way? Do we find ourselves in a position where we no longer care what other people think? At least not as much as we care what Jesus thinks. That we're not concerned about what other things we should be doing or what might be proper, but we just completely abandon ourselves to love and worship of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. If we don't, I think it should give us reason to pause and wonder, have we experienced the love of God in the same way that this woman has? Have we recognized our position in front of God in the way that this woman has? Or are we more like Simon? We feel like, sure, maybe we've been forgiven, but we've been forgiven little. And if we are, it gives us a handicap in loving God. It sort of puts a limit on the amount of love that we're able to express. I hope that we are able to express love and worship to God in the same way that we see this woman thinking, with extravagant love. As our story ends, there's one more interaction that takes place here. Let's look at it in verse 48 through 50. And he said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." When Jesus claims to have forgiven the sins of this woman, whatever people were feeling at that time, they become extremely alarmed. You're claiming to forgive this woman's sins? Only God can forgive sins. We all know that only God can forgive sins. Who are you, Jesus, to claim that you can forgive sins? This is the power and the responsibility of the one true God. Exactly, Jesus says, exactly. Forgiving sins is something that only God can do. And he looks at the woman and says, "Your sins are forgiven." This causes people to be very upset with Jesus because they have not recognized that true forgiveness comes from Jesus. This woman recognizes it. So Jesus looks to her and says, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." As I was studying this passage over the last couple weeks and preparing for this message, I found the Lord taking me on a bit of an emotional journey. And as I started studying this passage and I was thinking about the woman, I realized that I am the woman, that I have a huge debt against God, that I am a sinner, and that there's nothing I can do to pay this off. And thinking about your sin is kind of depressing, right? And it brought me to kind of this low place. But then it actually got worse because I realized that I wasn't just this woman. I was actually Simon. Because I oftentimes don't recognize all of the sin in my life. I don't want to admit it. I want to pretend like it's not there. I don't want other people to see it. So I began to sink down even a little bit lower. But then as I continued spending time with the Lord in this, I came to a point of understanding the main point, the whole point of this story. Why do we find Jesus acting in this way? Why do we find Luke telling us about it? It's because he wants us to know that in order to love God deeply, we must understand the depth of our own sin and the even greater love and forgiveness that we have in Jesus. And as I thought about that, and I rested in that, I was able to come from this place of being discouraged about my sin to a place of just wanting to overflow in love and worship of my God. So I hope that this week, I hope and I pray that you can go on a similar journey, that you can spend some time thinking about your sin, becoming aware of your sin, maybe in ways that you haven't before, but then not getting stuck there, but recognizing that this great debt that you have, this great debt that we all have, has been completely forgiven, wiped away by Jesus. and that this would cause you to respond in extravagant love for our Lord and Savior as you become completely absorbed with him.